You are listening to a Romecast with Neil Kramer.
Thank you. This is the way.
This is the way.
This is the way.
Yeah, we don't want to do anything to scare your children. That's the last thing we want to do. We don't want to scare anybody.
Wrongness unsettled by truth. Wickedness disgraced by honour. Disavowal punished by devotion. Evil terminated by goodness. Unsettled, disgraced, punished, terminated. Evil is on notice. Its chief proponent filled with fury, because he knows that his time is short. His knowing and unknowing followers are doing everything possible to delay the inevitable. Though everything is unfolding exactly as foreseen, rising and falling, the rhythmic pulse of harmony and discordance, made and unmade, arrival and departure. Our spiritual education draws ever closer to its earthly conclusion. Thank God. At some point in life, all intelligent, sensitive people recognize that something is terribly wrong with the world. And honestly, most people swiftly turn away from that wrongness and silently vow to never truly look at it again. And so, for the rest of their lives, they go off and do lots of other absorbing things instead. But some people do not turn away. They face the wrongness. They suffer it. They stare into it and feel all the ensuing dread, anguish, exhaustion. The darkness engraving deep furrows in the heart. And amongst everything, the most constant of all feelings, sadness. A vast grey, tidal sadness. When you know in your bones that something is profoundly wrong with the world, two crucial questions inevitably arise. Why is it so awful? And who is responsible? I think today most people think that the nature of the corruption here stems from poor stewardship of our world at the hands of malevolent and ignorant people. That's the narrative that has been proclaimed for centuries by all mainstream institutions, and as such has become culturally normative. So most people believe that all the injustice and the creeping criminality, the profligacy, the reckless waste, the violence, the inequity, the poverty, the cruelty, and the general bloody wretchedness of everything is all primarily due to human beings. It's down to us. Who else could it be? And if human society was somehow organized in a more even-handed and kindly manner, then everything would be okay. Theologically speaking, this represents a classical naturalistic worldview, and it is incoherent at every level. To genuinely comprehend what is happening in our world, what is really happening, we must first clearly distinguish between two very diverging ways of perceiving reality: a naturalistic worldview and a supernaturalistic worldview. Knowing the difference between these two views is fundamental to identifying the why and the who which lie at the heart of our wrongness problem. But first, let us check our reference points. What is a worldview? A worldview is a philosophical and perceptive lens through which one experiences daily life. It determines how we see the world's objects, its functions, its people, its places, its reasons. And however simple or complex a worldview might be, however accurate or inaccurate, it decrees how and why you make your day-to-day decisions. Both in youth, in middle age, and in elderhood. It shapes your overarching life trajectory, what you do, where you go, and with whom. Because of what you believe, it contours your understanding of society, of politics, of history, of morality, government, philosophy, psychology, art, everything. All formed and regulated by a worldview. Your worldview determines the underlying experiential tone of your daily existence. It is the primary instrument for making contact with reality itself. More than sight, more than sound, touch, taste, smell. Those are sensory inputs, raw data, sure. But your worldview, housed in the non-physical mind, momentously decides what you make of it all. Why it's all here. And that governs what you do and what you don't do. What you see and what you don't see. What you commit and what you omit. Some worldviews represent objective reality rather well, and some do not. Some worldviews are truthful and constructive. They are healthy. And some worldviews are false and damaging. They are harmful. Logically, only one single worldview represents reality accurately. And I expect no one alive today has attained that view. But we can choose to transform and refine ourselves to get as close to perceiving reality as we can. Attain an increasingly real worldview. And we do so by accepting the divine invitation to care about and to rationally explore what is true. So, what an honest human seeks is, of course, an accurate worldview, a realistic one, based on actuality, a truthful perspective, a clean, clear picture of reality. Truth at all costs. Even if this worldview upsets the fictions we had previously maintained about life, especially then, even when truth destroys the world you used to live in. So, a worldview is something of great gravity and solemnity, really. It's not an afterthought, it's not a nice to have, but rather something intrinsic and essential, an autonomic facet of living, like breathing, like thinking and feeling, quite elementary to everyday life. So, what is a naturalistic worldview? A naturalistic worldview is a fundamentally materialist worldview. It's about what is measurable by human minds. What is measurable, either actual or theorized, is real. What is not, is not. Everything is the result of natural processes. The leading naturalistic worldview holds that there was a primal explosion a long time ago, deep in the black void of space, and various materials spewed outwards from that detonation. And we are one of the accidental products of that cosmic discharge. People, helicopters, rhododendrons, lemon sponge cakes, Welsh dressers, wombats, all essentially just assorted splodges of pointless matter. Nothing has any ultimate purpose. Animals propagate themselves for survival. Objects sit around for a while. And all for no particular reason. To no meaningful end. Everything is just here for a few weeks or a few billion years, with no purpose. The word science derives from a root word, skei, which means to split or divide, to incise. Hence the Greek schizein, to split, which is the same root for the word schizophrenia, by the way. Science, splitting, is measuring stuff. Measuring stuff and then theorizing things based on those measurements. A process in itself quite neutral, quite innocuous. In the hands of dishonest and prejudiced people, it is worthless and dangerous, as we've said before in these recordings. It's not hard to distort data for political reasons on all manner of subjects. Evolution, astronomy, medicine, nutrition, history, geology, the date, the oldness of objects, things like that. All this stuff can be quite comfortably founded on false science, false splitting, false measuring, repeatably bad consensus measuring, which is what science invariably becomes in the hands of wicked people, misleading, destructive. One of the stupidest imperial slogans of all time is "Follow the science," which means follow somebody's measuring, not measuring itself. You can't do that. That's what science pretends, but no, it's somebody's measuring. The measurings of Anthony Fauci, or the World Health Organization, or the American Medical Association, or the British Medical Association? Do you think it's wise to follow their measurings? Are these good people? Science, splitting, measuring, in the right hands, in the hands of honest, impartial, principled people, is a valuable human tool. It helps us to grasp how physical, chemical, and biological processes work, what they are, what they do. It assists us in devising new instruments, materials, medicines, technologies, and it can certainly heighten and advance our understanding of this world and ourselves. Science in the right hands, that is. In the naturalistic worldview, Earth is a dreadful mess because humans don't respect nature and each other properly. Naturalism places the why and the who of the wrongness squarely on humans. We don't look after the place right. We abuse and exploit stuff, both inanimate and animate. And we don't treat each other very well either. But if we handled things properly and agreeably, then everything would be okay. Because there's only us, so it's up to us. There's nothing else. In this mode of thinking, then, the big solution is massive ecological conservationism and radical social restructuring. These are the things that can make the world better. For no ultimate reason, by the way, just so all the flora and fauna can have a nicer time together. And if, by any chance, you can hear a throbbing, engine-y sound in the background, it's large ships passing through an ocean channel right next to me. It's quite a natural environment I'm in, actually. But there's lots of ships, boats, yachts, stuff like that. I'm sure you'll bear with me, thank you. So naturalism is synonymous with relativism and existentialism, i.e. nothing is absolutely objectively true or good, and we are fundamentally alone in an indifferent universe for no reason. Morality, therefore, is somewhat disposable to the naturalist, little more than a fleeting social caprice. And this is partly because reality itself is allowed to be distinctly different for each individual. Not the perception of it, but the thing itself. You can just make it up. Because there is no single objective reality, so the naturalist thinks. Everything is just made up on the spot, for each mad person. The outmoded ideas of good and evil, right, wrong, true, false, are no longer relevant, so judgment of those things can go. It has to go. Don't judge, they say. I'm not judging. No judgment. No good and evil. No right and wrong. And there most certainly is no God. That is distinctly in the realms of mythology, or at best, religious lifestyle choices. And if there is any polite allowance of such a nuisance, the thing must be either entirely mythologized, which we'll come to later, or thoroughly de-entitized and turned into a kind of New Age scientific non-local pulsing field phenomena. Certainly not an individual being, not a creator entity paying close attention to individuals and educating and judging them. Heaven forbid, no. The naturalistic worldview focuses exclusively on the nuts and bolts, material environment, and human society. That is all the world, just the physical world and the various goings on there. There is nothing else. It is a fundamentally carnal philosophy. Wow, there is a massive tanker thing going through the water now as I look, with goodness knows how many of those giant shipping containers on it. God knows what's in those. Honestly, I would say a naturalistic worldview is obligatory within the cult of empire. All mainstream national and international institutions currently must obey and teach this view. especially since the 1700s, when the twin movements of science and the Industrial Revolution changed the physical and social landscapes of Europe forever. And soon after, everywhere else on Earth fell into line. And with that rapid modernization came the abiding reflex of contempt and mockery of divinity. Hello.
Hi. Are
you coming to see the shipping container thing?
Just a fair flip.
It's vast, isn't it? Just wait for those people to go away. So now let's examine the supernaturalistic worldview. What is that? Supernaturalism advances the idea that reality includes substantially more than can be seen, more than can be measured. Everything is not just the result of natural, material processes. There is a deeper, higher, transcendent quality to life that is not physical, and therefore, of course, not subject to the physical laws of Earth. There are different kinds of supernaturalistic worldviews, of course, and various branches of supernaturalistic theology that go along with them. I would like to present what I believe is the most accurate and genuine supernaturalistic worldview, along with some of the accompanying theology. It is a rather classical worldview, nothing especially eccentric or tailored about it. It is a way of looking at the world that has been around for a very long time. Yet for me, nonetheless, it is a worldview, a lens, an experiential body of knowledge that required, on my part, thorough investigation, lengthy contemplation, before I could satisfy my reason, my instinct, my feelings, and most importantly, my soul. Satisfy all those bits of myself that this stuff is true. And I don't need it to be true. I don't need a supernaturalistic worldview. I don't need magic, or purpose, or an afterlife. I couldn't care less. But I do care what is true. And if that is a naturalistic worldview, good. And if that is a supernaturalistic worldview, good. But it ain't both. I just want to know what the body of evidence supports. And I do believe it overwhelmingly supports one of them. And I think you can probably guess which one I'm talking about. The classical supernaturalistic worldview has at its heart the presence of divinity. Not some impersonal wafting quantum singularity in the 11th dimension. Nope, nothing like that. But rather a being. An intelligent creator with thoughts and feelings and ideas. An omniscient entity. God. Elyon. The Lord of Hosts. Lots of names. Theos. Hence, theology, of course. The study and observation of Theos. And this heavenly creator has a plan. A grand and majestic project to create a family. And this plan has already been underway for quite some time. He, long ago, established the spiritual tier of his family, non-physical spirit beings, mostly living in an atemporal, spiritual dimension, outside time, occasionally inside time. And then he created the earthly tier of his family, physical human beings living in a material, temporal realm, inside time. The next major phase of the project is the coalescence of the spiritual and physical life forms into one space, one new ultra space, higher, better, perfect, teleos. A Greek word. Often when we come across that word in sacred writings, it appears to mean flawless, you know, spotless, without error. It can, but it often also means complete. Teleos means whole. And this family, a spirit being family, rigorously educated from the ground up, capable of physical entitization, living in a higher dimensional atemporal earth, having stewardship and creative dominion alongside God himself in his ascended human form. Yes, new real family and belonging. New real landscapes and creations. New real harmony and tranquility. New real adventure and exhilaration. New real intimacy and depth. Our current Earth, where none of these things can really be, is a temporary place of education. It is not our home. It is a dark, vanishing classroom, purposefully austere, knowingly evanescent. What does the supernaturalistic worldview offer as an explanation for what's wrong with the world? The world is depraved because some members of God's spirit being family and human being family became selfish. And over time, that selfishness turned to jealousy and destruction. Such a revolt against God was only a possibility because of God's decision to bestow free will upon his family. This incredible gift granted each entity the choice to either go onwards or be annihilated. Essentially by their own determinations in belief, character and conduct. We are allowed to exclude ourselves from the next stage of spiritual evolution. Most people, in fact, choose this. They throw it away. It is happening around us every single day. People checking out. Just giving up. Not so much killing themselves, just making excuses as to why they choose a life devoid of truth and divinity. And that is their God-given prerogative. People can lie to themselves if they wish. Free will is a major key to God's teachings on earth. Free will is so critical because it is bulletproof assurance that everyone who goes forward after death initiated this sacred transition through their own unpolluted thoughts and feelings, their own will. Initiated by man, accomplished and completed by God. Justified by God. A person responded to God's invitation to join his family by way of their own pristine, independent free will. An ability given by the sovereign to each human, explicitly and judiciously granted to see how they steward such power. Free will is holy power. Even the higher spirit being members of God's family are exposed to the hazards and pitfalls of free will, as well as its beauty and wisdom. Once that is, they leave the unified sphere of God's realm. Certainly, some members of God's spirit-being family fell. They fell from selfishness and evil, and instructed naive humans in improper practices. Right from the beginning, right from the very beginning. This is one of the root causes of the debauchery on Earth. The shameful incursion of fallen spirit beings and their illicit conditioning of guileless humans. And if that weren't enough, there is the prospect that some of these spirit beings also commingled energetically, biologically, spiritually with humans, and in so doing produced a semi-divine hybrid race. And these hybrids of various types further intensified the debasement and the violence here. So we end up with a very complex situation of multidimensional spiritual and physical fallenness, all a result of free will beings going against God's perfect and harmonious will. And there's a great controversy here, because for about 1500 years, the Imperial Institutional Romanist Church taught that the chief agent of chaos in the world is us. An abstract nod to distant Satan, yes, and his appointed tradecraft of temptation, sure. But as far as pragmatic day-to-day life was concerned, for the vast majority of ordinary people, the big problem on Earth is humans. We are the disease. That was the message from the Imperial Romanist Church, and it is the message today from modern empire. Same entity. Same deal from 500 AD all the way through to 2023. That's a long time. No wonder ordinary people mock Christianity. That was the whole idea. We messed it up from the beginning due to our inherent delinquency. What the first man and woman did in a higher dimensional Edenic realm, that is, going against God's instructions to not yet inquire into the dangerous mysteries of the knowledge of good and evil, ultimately ruined things for everyone, and we're all pitiful and tainted because of that. That's the standard institutional church teaching, Catholic and Protestant. Most regular Christians are taught, directly or tacitly, to think and feel along those lines. Not healthy humility and redemption, but wounding self-depreciation, sometimes verging on debasement. So imagine then how things might change if man's disobedience was not the sole cause of the mayhem on Earth. What if it wasn't just us? What if there was another major reason for the unbridled corruption in this world? A credible theological view that articulates other causes for earthly corruption. That would be an important thing to know, would it not? When certain spirit beings descended into the lower temporal reaches of the creation, both astral and earthly, they became vulnerable to the inducements of darkened self, and dissent crept into their heart. And before long, that dissent became outright evil. That is, destructively oppositional to God's love. Which cannot happen in the higher realms, where there is a unifying consonance. But lower down, outside that sanctified coalescing accord, independent beings may choose evil. And that is a fundamental part of giving real freedom, free will, to any created being. the risk of misuse, damage, dishonor, an annihilated soul, and, of course, proper use, upliftment, honor, an eternal soul. So it is, we learn, that here, from within the fetid sepulchral hollows of this woeful disc, it was fallen spirit beings that were a primary cause of Earth's debasement. Not just humans doing dumb things. We certainly, certainly do plenty of pathetic, wicked, reckless stuff, for sure. But the magnitude of the problem here comprises other factors. Something outside of us, before us, non-human, harmful, betraying. This remains a controversial minority view because of two potentially inflammatory aspects. First, as we've said, it lays heavy blame for Earth's afflictions on ancient spiritual beings, commonly thought of as angels, going against truth, going against God. Which in itself is quite a leap for most people, even to think of such a thing. Secondly, this worldview runs the risk of some humans becoming complacent in their own lives. If they feel that the horrible state of things isn't really their fault, so they just sort of sit back and think, well, why bother? And maybe just coast along with very little impetus to pursue or care about divinity or people or goodness or truth or anything. Just be secretly selfish wankers. To get a little more definition on this mystery, this primal mystery, let's cast our minds back to a very early theological picture, a picture of humans and spirit beings interacting. God's judicious and loving act for the first man and woman was for them to be made in God's own image. That is, volitional, soulful beings. Located in a beautiful garden, eastward in Eden. To have their own territory. And to learn about life, whilst in close relationship with their wise teacher, their immaculate guardian, their loving creator. Eden can be thought of as a harmonic physical realm, overlapped by a heavenly realm. And by virtue of this protective dimensional shielding, everything would be much more balanced, more cordial, and certainly more secure and benign, compared to the pitiless conditions of the grim temporal wilderness that is the Earth outside of Eden. Both learning environments, one just much more harmonious than the other. As we know, the garden contained a number of trees, these likely being symbolic foreshadowings of the future dynamic of divine relationship. Trees as a living representation of sanction and sustenance, life and wisdom. Lots of trees, but there were two special trees. Firstly, the tree of life, perfectly real in its power to grant immortality to those who share in the proximity of its influence, imbibe its generative force. That specific location signifying the source of God's renewing life force. And outside of the garden, away from the tree of life, is therefore mortality, away from close divine relationship, death, certain death. There was also another very distinctive tree, right in the middle of the garden. The tree of the knowledge of good and evil. A tree which provided a very particular path to wisdom, which, if one partook of it, resulted in necessary expulsion from the Edenic realm, where also the tree of life is, and outwards to where it is not. Hence the admonition, in the day that you eat from it, you will surely die. Or more literally in Hebrew, dying, you shall die. And this can have both a spiritual meaning as well as a juridical meaning. That sound is a bald eagle, by the way, would you believe? Juridical, theologically speaking, means pertaining to God's law, like a lawful consequence for a transgression. Here, I believe, as do many others, that the phrase, dying you shall die, is God saying, look, if you eat from this particular tree of knowledge, you'll necessarily lose your spiritual connectivity and permanence here. Whilst you go about the long and arduous task of attaining discernment in a profoundly polarized temporal realm, you will have to become mortal if you eat from that tree. Instantly mortal. And so, in that very day, you'll immediately begin to decay. Slowly but surely, your form and life will wear away. Dying, you shall die. And though Adam lived to be 930, a literal age, which sounds like a very long time by today's standards, but in fact was par for the course then. Most early humans lived that long, about a millennium. Adam nonetheless was mortal. Adam was finite. Adam died. And so did everyone else following him, because of the decision Adam and Eve made. Our ancestors chose the mortal, narrow, hard path to wisdom. As we talk about Genesis being part of the Bible, part of Scripture, part of the biblical canon, canon just meaning measuring standard or rule, it is worth remembering that there are other very important related spiritual texts too. I would classify five main bodies of sacred texts. Firstly, the canon of the biblical scriptures, that's 66 books. The pseudepigrapha, that's between 60 to 80 books, depending on exactly how you classify and divide pseudepigrapha, which we'll come to in a minute, what that word is if you're not familiar with it. Thirdly, credible monastic texts. Let's say about 50 of those books, in my view. Then, credible mystical texts. Maybe, again, around 50 books. And credible theological texts. Again, perhaps around another 50 key books that one could read. There's hundreds of these things, of course, but let's say 50 monastic, 50 mystical, 50 theological. On top of the canon, on top of the pseudepigrapha. And as I say, my numbering here of the best credible mature texts is arrived at by discounting the mountain of rubbish, monastic, mystical and theological books. So you end up all in all with those five categories, canon, pseudepigrapha, monastic, mystical, theological. You end up with a figure of, let's say, around 300 books, just to round it off. And those books range from about 30,000 words each, in works like Jeremiah, Genesis, Psalms, Ezekiel, to wee little things like Titus, Jude, 2nd and 3rd John, which are basically about a page each. So in contemporary times today, these books would be more accurately considered as documents. It takes a long time to develop a reasonable understanding of these sacred texts, I'd say between 30 to 50 years. Not just reading, studying, examining, corroborating, contrasting, contemplating. The biblical canon and the pseudepigrapha alone represent a lifetime's work for many serious, trustworthy scholars. And after decades of study, gradually gaining expertise in symbolism, deciphering, context, and comprehension, it is quite true and reasonable to state that only then an authentic cosmological picture begins to emerge. You have to bloody work for it. You have to strive for it. Endeavour to crystallise it. It doesn't just jump out. But it's there, all right. You don't have to read into the text. The very opposite, you have to read it outwards. And then road test it, crash test it. all to satisfy yourself of the legitimacy of this cosmology. Important. Or to disregard it, if it's not true. To throw it out. But if it is true, then you actually have in your hands a real picture of what the world is, how it works, what it's for, when it came into being, when it's disappearing, and what happens afterwards. The history, the logic, the facts and figures, the guidance, the principles, the prophecy, the wisdom, the metaphysics, the esoteric secrets, it is all there. It's all there to be considered, if one wishes. And as there are always new people coming to these recordings, perhaps starting with this very one, I'm always mindful to not use or overuse lingo without at least some kind of explanation. So, pseudepigrapha refers to a body of documents mostly written somewhere in the period of around 500 BC to 200 AD. Somewhere in there. Sometimes a little later. But roughly that to round it off. Technically, the word pseudepigrapha means false writing. Pseudo-false epigraph writing. However, this superficial definition is somewhat misleading in my view. It doesn't always mean forgeries or fakes. Pseudepigrapha can also be thought of as writings where an author, for a variety of reasons, has opted to use a pseudonym, or a pen name, or a traditional authorship name. So you have these pseudonymous books. An author might do this for a variety of reasons. Sometimes to point the reader to the relevant subject matters and timelines being considered. Sometimes to conceal and protect his identity. Sometimes to genuinely act on behalf of the individual he is writing about. And sometimes to deceive people. Depends on the credibility and the integrity of the author. The subject matter, the quality of the text itself, the relevance and unity of it, and the inherent picture of spiritual reality. For example, First Enoch, sometimes called the Book of Enoch, is a classical piece of pseudepigrapha. Very significant, very noteworthy. It is directly referenced in the Bible, and it certainly shaped important articulations in the New Testament in terms of thought and language. Even so, as yet, it is not precisely clear who actually put pen to paper and when. Dates range between 2nd and 4th century BC to way, way before then. No one, as yet, is certain, and scholars have already been wrong about it before. That is until the Dead Sea Scrolls material, the Qumran cave findings, helped to substantiate its authenticity and its dating, First Enoch. Its early dating, that is. They thought it was much later. When evaluating ancient documents that may or may not be sacred and important, you're looking for various qualities. And classically, there are five main check marks. Firstly, authorship. Who wrote it? Secondly, has the book been well regarded by mature, educated spiritual scholars over an extended period? Thirdly, does the book represent consistent theological doctrine? Fourthly, does it fit in with the pattern that the biblical materials soundly represent? And finally, does the book characterize the great moral and spiritual standards that would signal an inspired work, alliance between human and Holy Spirit? And then there are a host of other points, of course. Is it supernaturally inspired, the text? Did God inspire the person's whole life to write something personal and genuine, and yet universal in its embodiment of specific timeless wisdom? As well as all the other hands that touched it, the hands that scribed, copied, buried, hid, cleaned, deciphered, translated the texts and all that? Is God capable of something like that? Is he powerful enough to inspire a whole sequence of events to bring a text to your eyes or ears? So evaluating texts is a complex business. And it requires intelligence, of course. and diligence and patience and, above all, honourable people to carry out that careful discrimination that's so vital. And there's no doubt in my mind that the pseudepigraphal texts are of serious value for both biblical scholarship and general spiritual education, because they offer a window into the hearts and minds of our supernaturally attuned ancestors, ancient ancestors. And crucially, exactly how many of these texts, including the Bible itself, were perceived and formed. And over time, one realizes that many of these apparently arcane works are in fact much closer to describing objective reality than most people would dare to believe. You can get a nice collection of pseudepigrapha in a 2-volume set called The Old Testament Pseudepigrapha, edited by a guy called James Charlesworth. It is a large, curated reference work and represents the pseudepigrapha very adequately. And as I've said, quite frankly, you could easily spend every hour of the rest of your life studying it, just that 2-volume set. It is a mysterious thing, very enigmatic, with many unknowns, many gaps, many puzzles, and trustworthy eminent theologians write whole books on just a few pages of this stuff. It's a lot of work.
I don't know what you tell those students of yours, Robert, but I'd like to tell them something. The truth, for once. The real truth.
And what's that, Isabel?
That everything just gets worse and worse, and it's time we stop pretending it doesn't. When we were young, up to 1914, the world was sensible and safe and kind, and even if people didn't have much money, they had most of the things they wanted. They could be happy in a simple, easy way, because life seemed good. And afterwards, after those years of great black casualty lists every day, oh, it was never the same again. Never the same. But it wasn't too bad. We still didn't know all the horrors and cruelties and miseries. But then everything got worse and worse. Look at us now. Just look at us. With only a few years more and all the colour and fun and life gone forever. I tell you, it's heartbreaking.
Shut that door.
I want some protein.
What's the matter? Are you bored?
Bored? Yes. Yes, I am. I don't find the men on this island very satisfactory. They have no complexities. You look at them and you know all about them right away.
I appear to you to have complexities.
You have many layers. At this moment, you're thinking many things.
It's true enough. Milligan, put that on my bill.
No, I'll pay for it.
If you insist.
And you? Aren't you bored?
No. Not at all.
Then why were you alone at the cave this morning? And yesterday? And the day before yesterday. I mean, it must mean that you don't find the women on this island very satisfactory either.
What if I prefer to be alone?
Now, you're trying to make a fool of me.
There are people like that, you know. But I must confess, I'm not one of them.
Then I'm right, Mr. Drake.
See, you found out my name.
That's not too difficult when you're interested in someone, is it?
No, it's not too difficult, Cleo.
One of the most remarkable things that the classical supernaturalistic worldview reveals is the tremendous significance that God places on mankind's free will. The massive value and worth he attributes to it. He takes great pains to protect, to uphold, and respect that will given to us. The will he gave to you, your power to decide. The creator of the universe himself, personally, individually, valuing you and inviting you to trust in him through his gift. And it is perhaps this particular quality of mankind that is reflective of quite how we are made in God's image. He really wants us to come to truth, and through truth, inevitably, to him, by way of our thoughts, our feelings, our actions. He doesn't want pre-programmed robots. He wants free-thinking, genuine, humble, loving, unbound souls. And as a side note, we say man, as in mankind, because man, Adam, is the name of our species, as articulated in Genesis 5:2. The modern term, human, which we think of as sort of more equitable and neutral, is really just from the Latin humanus, which simply means of man, belonging to man. So, it doesn't make much difference, does it really? And even more interesting when you understand that the Hebrew word Adama, reflective of the word Adam, means ground, earth, clay, red clay, field. So man means ground or earth. Earth people, ground people, people of the ground. There's nothing wrong with the word human. I use it all the time. But there's also nothing wrong with the word man, or mankind either, to describe all of us. Man fairly and accurately describes every single one of us, male and female, as earth people, ground people. That's what it means. Free will beings test their will against the will of others, against authorities. Just like ordinary kids experience with their ordinary mums and dads. Sometimes, often, children go against mum and dad's instructions in their exercise of free will, rightly or wrongly, an immature disobedience, however naive or innocent or stupid or willful. Young people need to feel the consequences of the acts that follow on from their free will. And it appears that God gave us the same deal. And so, if the first people wished, Adam and Eve, they could obtain their education the hard way. Imbibe from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, leave Eden, away from the tree of life, be mortal, and live and die in the strange wasteland that we now all see before us. And even in this fallen state, it still more than adequately provides the education and opportunity for straightening and purifying that God intended for us. Just a narrower path. And to make matters infinitely more complicated, a spirit being, Nahash, which we think of as the serpent, purposefully deceived the woman about the consequences of acquiring the knowledge of good and evil, who then passed that disinformation on to Adam, her husband. They both consumed the fruit from that tree. And in so doing, directly and indirectly determined to venture to temporal earth and get first-hand roller coaster schooling in good and evil, by being totally immersed in it, downward. A fateful choice to go against God's guidance and proper instruction, yes. But what guilt is reckoned against an innocent, guileless woman and man, cruelly deceived by a spirit being more crafty and subtle than any earthly creature, as Genesis 3 discloses? Is earth depraved exclusively because of humans? No. Logically, no. The origin and picture of Earth's wrongness is more multifaceted than that. The Earth was depraved and smeared because of free will beings disobeying God, yes. Humans in their primitive misconduct, like Adam and Eve, yes. And spirit beings, supernatural beings, in their calculated and felonious transgressions, yes. The fallen Kokahim, fallen Elohim, fallen angels, they knew better. Theirs was a more disturbing and egregious crime because they knew better. They were given custodian responsibilities, safeguarding tender new human beings. Instead, some of them chose to do the unthinkable and intentionally hurt God's children, physically, mentally, emotionally, spiritually, all the while knowing the damage and injustice of such an act. Contempt, distortion, evil. The fallen spirit beings taught humans various things. How to create empires, how to wage war, how to manipulate, fornicate, do spells, magic, divination, alchemy. All for bad purpose. And most disastrously of all, how to worship negative spirit beings as gods. The template this for many pagan, Persian, Greek, Hindu, and Roman gods. All kinds of detrimental teachings and methods and rituals that were enormously inappropriate for these new human babies in God's family. Imagine an adult babysitter given charge over an 8-year-old, a 9-year-old, and then teaching that kid how to start fires, about having sex, about killing people, about using drugs, about revering and venerating demons. Unsupportable criminal behavior. From the fallen spirit beings, we also get all kinds of supernatural crossbreeds, hybrids. They, the fallen, experimented with all manner of abominations, part divine, part human, part animal. Creatures. For real. Not mythological, not figurative, real. Part of the supernatural world. Some of them are still here, because they're not entirely mortal. They have spirit being heritage, non-physical, so not entirely subject to earth laws as physical beings ordinarily are. Some evil has been removed. Some remains. Otherwise we could not complete our education. Part of the carefully balanced divine syllabus. We asked for it. And we are quite capable of overcoming evil by the holy power that has been given to us, free will. Free will is our devastating, evil-crushing superpower. Everyone alive is able to identify evil and reject it, if they wish. No created being can touch your soul. They can mess with your body, but not your soul. So honestly, the bad guys are nothing to fear. As scripture states in Matthew 10:28, do not fear those who kill the body, but are unable to kill the soul, but rather revere God, who is able to destroy both soul and body. Your soul is untouchable to all but God. And He wishes most earnestly to preserve and cherish it, sustaining your choice to live in goodness. Many people have persuaded themselves that evil doesn't exist, and subsequently they are predisposed to excusing it and even becoming it. Look around. Evil is mainstreamed. Every country, every city. It is the evil culture the Empire force-feeds to children through schools and media. It's not new. It's happened before. If you think our world is uniquely horrible now, let me tell you something. If I take you in a time machine back to ancient Greece and Rome, I will show you a level of depravity that makes our problems seem pretty unremarkable and small fry. A thorough reading of history and their disgraceful degeneracy, their brutal, pompous, homicidal culture, unchecked sexual degradation, really puts things into perspective. Doesn't mean our problems are therefore immaterial or tolerable, not at all. But when contrasted with the horrors of Babylon, Persia, Greece, Rome, our social deterioration is nothing new and not nearly as vile. Empire would love it to be, but it's not there. It's more pervasive because of technology. But it's still operating mostly on the persuasion level, on the interior mental emotional level, as you might say, rather than the bloody savage, non-consensual, physical coercion and violence level. And when you place these historical epochs side by side, you come to see this rhythmic, periodic collapse of culture. And it's always based on the same thing. Forsaking God. Willingly, knowingly, unashamedly, abandoning divinity. And when people persistently forsake God, persistently, he forsakes them. He moves away from them, as far as they move away from him. And in his withdrawal, the culture then reveals its brazen degeneracy. God is demonstrating something. The degeneracy is a punishment. He's showing us something, teaching something here. If such people sincerely apologize to him and seek redemption, God forgives them and works to heal them. If they do not, which is a very large percentage of people, he finally punishes them in the most severe way imaginable. An admonishment and sentence that is carried out after death. There is no escape. A wicked person cannot just run the clock out. Death is no escape for anyone, ever. Death only places you squarely in God's hands. Fascinating to consider that it was potentially the jealousy, the envy of one supernatural being, one angel, that kick-started all this misery, this whole gloomy adventure into fallenness. One spirit being did not like the idea that God's new family members, humans, were eventually going to rise to great spiritual heights in the heavenly realms. That they would advance to join or even exceed some or all of the existing spirit being family. And whilst most spirit beings, in the right minds of course, the collective body of the Elohim, rejoiced at this awesome new godly creation and the eventual ascension of the souls of humans, as I say, at least one angel became twisted in his own narcissism, his own selfishness. In James 3:14-16, we read this. If you have bitter jealousy and selfish ambition in your hearts, do not boast and be false to the truth. This is not the wisdom that comes down from above, but is earthly, unspiritual, demonic. For where jealousy and selfish ambition exist, there will be disorder and every vile practice. And in the apocryphal book, sometimes called the Wisdom of Solomon, we read this more specifically. For God created us for incorruption, and made us in the image of his own eternity. But through an adversary's envy, death entered the world, and those who belong to his company experience it. And that word adversary is sometimes interpreted as devil. So it looks like what began as seething resentment eventually became insurrection, revolt against goodness itself. Because when you turn against God, you are turning against goodness, turning against absolute love, absolute truth, absolute beauty, absolute harmony. A genuine spiritual person is impelled to supernaturalism. Inherently, instinctively, intuitively. All the important things are invisible. We know that. Of course, we are at total liberty to gladly observe and enjoy the physical world, appreciate the beauty, the landscape, the mountains, the wonderful people, the animals, the rivers, the oceans, the sunsets, and the art and the music and the literature that authentically reflect those things in our relationships with them. Yes, of course, naturally. And yet, our heart is not quite here. It never was. It is not given to the earth. It does not really belong here. As long-time listeners will know, empire is my term for what we also think of as the deep state, the cabal, the control system, the distortion, the globalists, etc. The bad guys behind world governments. And why did I choose the word empire all those years ago? Well, if you read the book of Daniel, written about 535 BC, it was, containing much prophecy and cosmology, the idea is presented there that there are several kingdoms stretching out through different epochs, but actually they are really just one big mega kingdom, a perpetual empire. So that's a term that I thought was bang on. It felt right in name and history and tone. And I define empire as the human administration of a negative supernatural force. What supernatural force? A compound of several supernatural forces. Firstly, fallen watchers. Which nicely returns us to the subject of negative supernatural beings that we've been talking about. So let's take a deeper look at these beings, the scrupulous and the unscrupulous spiritual entities, these watchers. The word watcher, in Aramaic, ir, I-Y-R, or I-R, means sentinel, guardian, or wakeful one, plural, irin, derived from a root word, ur, U-R, meaning awake, or raised. So singular, ir, plural, irin, watcher, watchers. A watcher is a God-created spiritual entity designed to help God's project to both constitute and raise a family. It is a sentinel spirit being. We could parallel this with the Greek term angelos, where of course we get the word angel from. It's not quite the same thing, actually, yet over time, the modern usage of the term angel, rather than its meaning of heavenly messenger, now denotes a whole type or classification of spirit being, rather than the role or function of that being. So frankly, the words watchers and angels are often transposable today, Even in Jacinius's Hebrew and Chaldee Lexicon, an important scriptural study book, published in around the 1830s, when the writer mentions watchers and holy ones, he puts in brackets afterwards, angels. Because that's the common understanding. So we note that. But we are going to focus on the language that the original documents actually used at the time. We encounter the word watcher in Daniel chapter 4, where the writer says, "And behold, an angelic watcher, a holy one, descended from heaven." We also hear about them in pseudepigraphal works like 1st Enoch and Jubilees, where additionally it becomes clear that there are both good and bad watchers. Watchers who retain their holiness in heavenly spaces and on earth, holy watchers, sometimes called Kaddish. And watchers who turned bad, fallen watchers, for which there are various names, which we won't go into tremendous detail now, as that in itself is quite a lengthy study. These spirit beings, these watchers, are all supposed to be here to help, to be a positive influence, mostly to watch and help invisibly from the parallel spiritual realm, a dimension overlapping ours but quite imperceptible to the untutored eye. Watchers are meant to be inconspicuous, vigilant, good, supportive, taking great care to avoid interfering with our free will, as is their instruction from the boss, God. So they are expertly unobtrusive, mostly totally undetectable. Certainly if you don't know what you're looking for, you'd never know they are here. They do occasionally intervene perceptibly, but mostly they remain under the radar, in the background, anonymous. That's what they're supposed to do. And as we know, calamitously, some of the watchers went bad. They abdicated their responsibilities. They left their proper place. They left their first estate. As is recorded in the scripture of Jude 6-7, "And the angels which kept not their first estate, but left their own habitation, he hath reserved in everlasting chains, under darkness unto the judgment of the great day, as Sodom and Gomorrah, and the cities around them, in a similar manner to these, having given themselves over to sexual immorality, and gone after strange flesh, are set forth as an example, suffering the vengeance of eternal fire." And later in Jude 12-13, speaking of these fallen watchers, we read, "Clouds they are, without water, carried about of winds, trees whose fruit withereth, without fruit, twice dead, plucked up by the roots, raging waves of the sea, foaming out their shame. Wandering stars, to whom is reserved the blackness of darkness forever."
Wandering stars, for whom is reserved.
I would say that the scriptural and pseudepigraphal texts point to a self-regarding vanity and a piercing jealousy in the hearts of certain fallen spirit beings. One initial seditious leader, then poisoned followers. A bitterness that mutated into corruption and evil. When precisely did that happen? Some think it to be somewhere between the events of Genesis 1:31 and Genesis 3, that is, after God had finished creating the earth and declared it good. If all was well and healthy at that point, after that declaration of goodness, the problem must have occurred afterwards, sometime between earth being made and divinely considered as good, and the episode with Nahash, the supernatural serpent entity that deceived Eve and Adam, and the resultant expulsion of mankind from the garden. We know that the negative supernatural being Nahash was not just doing a routine job for God. He wasn't just tempting and playing adversary, as was his task, because he was punished by God. He was punished afterwards, which God does not do to his angels who fulfill their allotted tasks. So God was clearly not at all impressed with how this serpent being deceived the woman. Indeed, God said to this very entity, Because you have done this, cursed are you more than all cattle, and more than every beast of the field. On your belly you will go, and dust you will eat all the days of your life. That is casting out language, being downgraded as mortal, finite, temporal, weak, vulnerable, and unlike humans, with zero chance of redemption or resurrection. So, certainly, at this point, we already have negative spirit beings messing around with humans. It is possible that the initial spirit being revolt could have happened before the Earth's creation. After all, Genesis 1 is not necessarily an account of everything. That is not stated. It is an account of the creation of our world. The Samayim firmament vault that covers the Earth, and the creation of the elemental earth plane itself, with all its oceans and rivers and mountains and forests and plants and animals. That is what Genesis 1 covers. But whichever, whenever, there were already some seriously dodgy things going on in the lower heavenly realms, because when there were only just two human beings in existence, the serpent being Nahash was already bad. Logic permits the possibility that the envy of the spirit beings, their jealousy at humanity's high divine appointment and future prestige and authority, might well be happening before the humans were ever made. The jealous angels saw the plans before creation, and at some point in the lower realms, descending, they started to become crooked. Remember, outside of the higher astral heavenly realms, downward, 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 where we encounter polarity and temporality, the free will testing zone, these conditions make it possible for corruption to occur, even in prior Elohim spirit beings. We see in the scriptural text of Job, in chapter 38, where spirit beings were responding to God's laying the foundations of the earth before humans were made, when the morning stars, spirit beings, sang together, and the sons of God, Bene Elohim, spirit beings, shouted for joy. So they are witnessing creation. So somewhere between here and Adam and Eve in Eden, something was going awry in certain souls. And as I say, metaphysically speaking, with my background in esoteric education, the esoteric overlap would indicate that when spirit beings descend from, as some would say, the 7D, the seventh dimension, where there is only unity, which a Christian would call the highest heaven, and then down into the 6D, where there is individualism, and further downward into the 5D and 4D, even before the 3D, you then have, as we say, polarity, temporality in those lower realms. These being purposeful, celestial teaching mechanics for free will training. And with them, accordingly, you also have the possibility of individual distortion, wrongness. And that's where we hit the jealousy and corruption problem. The shocking spectacle of former Elohim godly family going bad. So what we can say with a great deal of confidence is that spirit beings, watchers, went against God and indulged themselves in our world, and they ruinously disrupted human development. They momentarily dislocated God's project to raise a loving family. They behaved wickedly, knowingly. They and their progeny hurt humans. They hurt animals, they hurt the plants, and even the land itself, the soil, the sky, the water. They and their monstrous hybrid creations just wrecked stuff, wrecked it. So we've said a lot of stuff here. Let's summarise for a moment. Let's gather together some of the information we've been discussing about these fallen supernatural beings. The negative supernatural force behind Empire is actually, as I said earlier, a composite. A composite of three main supernatural classifications, which I would describe in the following manner. Number 1. Fallen Watchers, Ir. Corrupt supernatural prior angelic beings, with a leader or leaders. Many names arise in this respect. Shemihazar, Samyaza, Artakov, Remeshel, Kokabel, Armamahel, Ramel, Daniel, Zikel, Barakel, Asiel, Hermanai, Matarel, Ananel, Setawel, Samshiel, Sariel, Tumiel, Turiel, Yamiel, Yahadiel, Mastima, Belial, Beliar, and last but not least, Satan. Precise identities, ordering, hierarchy, and naming are unclear. But a leader with fellow captains and soldiers beneath them, a platoon of fallen watchers, 200 of them, according to certain numbers, which technically would make them actually more of a company rather than a platoon. The original watchers were imprisoned and bound by the good Archangel Michael for 70 generations, until final destruction. Other fallen watchers present too, ruling over geographical regions, territories, in their roles as so-called principalities and powers and princes. Not human. This is incredibly important to factor into our understanding of supernatural depravity. Watchers here, for real, then and now. Number two, hybrid creatures, which is suggested in scripture and expanded upon in the pseudepigrapha. New life forms not created by God. Crossbreeds. Watchers with humans, with animals. Hybrids. The most prominent of which are the Nephilim, giants. Not human, not watchers, something else. Real giant beings who lived in large numbers across the lands of our earth for a long time. Different groups ranging in height from 8 feet tall to 14 feet tall to 30 feet tall. And the descendants of the Nephilim recorded throughout Old Testament biblical history, in Genesis, in Numbers, in Deuteronomy, in Joshua, in 2 Samuel, in 1 Chronicles, in Isaiah, and in Amos. This is history. And within this hybrid classification, we also have what we could call demigods, humans with watcher parentage, supermen, famous and infamous, and tripartite hybrids, humans with watcher parentage crossed with animals. A human with eagle's wings, or the head of a lion, or the body of a fish. All the kinds of things we see, of course, in Babylonian, Egyptian, Greek, and Roman art. But real. Not the imaginings of a primitive people. Real, living creatures. Real hybrids. Not mythology, history. And finally, number three, demons. Two main cases for the origins of these guys. Case one, they are the spirit bodies of destroyed Nephilim. Case two, they are another distinct class of spirit being. Could be either, don't know. Though I am inclined to the former case, demons being the roaming spirits of dead Nephilim. And when you profile demonic behaviour in real life, they long to get into physical form, humans or animals, to incarnate, as you might say, to possess physicality, in order to satiate their corporeal appetites, in various foul manners. And if you think about the lineage of the demon, a fallen watcher father, an earth mother, and their own embodiment as Nephilim, we can well understand their spirit's urgency to get tenure, to get into, to be inhabiting a physical form. Such was their prior history of sensual craving and vulgar carnality. So we have a threefold supernatural cast of characters behind Empire. Fallen Watchers, Hybrids, Demons. These are the entities towards whom you may direct your displeasure. They are the enemy. Watchers, Hybrids, Demons. As real as rocks and trees. As present with us in our everyday life as the sun and the moon. Here, actual. Hidden only by the conceit and pomposity of the totally despiritualized contemporary naturalistic worldview. A sickness that began in the 16th century gaining momentum during the Industrial Revolution of the 18th and 19th centuries and culminating in the presiding carnality of the undead machine world of our day. The supernaturalistic worldview puts a very different perspective on people like Trudeau, Biden, Macron, Inslee, Newsom, bloody Kathy Hochul, Gretchen Whitmer and such like. These people apparently in power are in fact very small, very irrelevant menials. No authority at all in themselves. These empire-owned creatures and thousands like them are really just mannequins. With their operators prompting them what to say, what to sign, what to do, where to go, with whom and when. Do as you're told or else. These mannequins are never elected and never have individual power. They are selected and permitted the appearance of authority in the mind of imperial citizens only, who are in themselves just another kind of mannequin. Mannequins obeying mannequins. Honestly, some of the leadership mannequins do not even technically exist as human beings, in the way that we ordinarily understand what an organic human life form is. What we see on screen and on stage is often not real. Both physical and non-physical manifestations, synthetic, very commonplace, very well known. Just not something anyone in the fake mainstream naturalistic worldview narrative is allowed to talk about or think about, of course. And in this sense, mainstream culture has one aim, one single aim, to erase God from our cosmology, to despiritualize you, to have you deny truth, honor, divinity. You are gaslighted until these things begin to no longer have any real meaning anymore. Until they no longer exist. And to this end, over centuries, indeed over millennia, fallen watchers have developed a mainstream culture that seduces people to live against God, to disregard and deny his existence. And all the mainstream primary schools and elementary schools and high schools and universities and workplaces and institutions teach you to just go about your own business, your own career, your own passion, your own security, your own pleasure, your own fulfillment, and nothing else. That's all. Don't worry what is true and what things mean. That stuff's not for you. You just drive your little car, do your little things, watch your little movies, play your little games, go on your little vacations, live in your little house, and keep your little fucking mouth shut. Shut down your emotions. Bury your moral conscience. Stop thinking. Stop believing. To augment the despiritualization project, Empire fabricates artificial grassroots movements, as we know. A modern example is what they're currently doing with human sexuality. Making a mockery of it, basically. Desanctifying it. Denaturalizing it. Imperially engineered movements that have nothing to do with freedom, nothing to do with love, nothing to do with equity, nothing at all to do with protecting people, nothing to do with acceptance. Of course not. The depraved sexualization and degendering of men, women, and children is to pave the way to mainstreaming paedophilia with the ultimate goal of normalizing consensual human sacrifice. Adults and children deciding that they no longer wish to live in the world, maybe because of depression or to remove their unsustainable carbon footprint or something, and would like instead to die in a loving ritual with other loving children and adults. Can you see that down the line? I can. Empire wants willing sacrifices. Just inching along with these small incremental processes of introducing, slowly, culturally endorsed fornication into adult, teenage, and infant life. Whether you think homosexuality and transgenderism are inherent states, or chosen behaviours, or mental disorders, that's up to you. But we must keep Empire's sexualization tactics away from children and young people, period. Empire wants to sexualize and sacrifice children, and they want us to consent to that, to give hearty approval of it. Sacrificing children is foundational to Watcher and Demon presence. It is fuel for their embodiment, for control structures, and for the fracturing of God's family. They've done it from the beginning, for millennia, uninterrupted, initially in public, and then underground. And now they want to do it in broad daylight, with public approval again. Part of fallen Watcher worship culture. From day one, thousands of years ago, uninterrupted industrial human trafficking to feed negative supernatural beings and their enthralled human mannequins from the beginning, 100%. And now, abortion clinics, corrupt humanitarian charity foundations and emergency aid agencies, prostitution and large underground networks that we shudder to think about, real. Sexualizing children is a path to feeding them to demons. And this programming begins early in school, early with kids' TV, movies, games. Children who are sent to normal schools are the worst affected by this conditioning. If we are able, and we are, we should not send our kids to normal kindergarten, normal elementary, normal middle, normal primary, normal high schools, normal colleges. Unless you manage to find some exceptional, independent, genuine Christian school with a track record of proven, mature, honourable leadership, or something very parallel to that, with a statement of faith that forbids sexual immorality, a place that teaches wisely on the sacredness of the body, the totality of consent, and lifelong devoted adult relationships being the only basis for mutual sexual expression. You'd need to find a place with these principles, at the very least, to entrust your kids' education to. Or homeschool. I know homeschooling is hard work, but the lives we bring into this world deserve that high-level investment. And homeschooling networks, I know mums and dads who do this, run by responsible, noble people, can make it a lot more doable, practically speaking. Now, when the kids are old enough to choose sensibly for themselves, they then move into a situation of selecting their own educational institutions and methods. Sure, but whilst they're still between the ages of 0 to 14, it's your responsibility to wisely guide them. Make no mistake, every single day, Empire is actively attacking children in the schools, in a way no one has seen for centuries. Balance. Empire is not all-powerful. Far from it. It has many frailties. In principle, metaphysically and supernaturally speaking, it was deauthorized 2,000 years ago. Now, judgment is upon this world. Empire is on death row, and whilst there, it subsists only by way of our consent. And of all its weaknesses, this one restraint is the most important to understand. Watchers, hybrids, and demons cannot countermand your free will. They may coax, entice, flatter, scare, tempt and persuade you into consenting to evil and becoming evil, but they cannot in any way revoke the power of your will. Your will is an endowment from God. Therefore it carries that sovereign seal. They can bruise your body and yourself, but they cannot overturn your will, ever. All they can do is ask you to ignore your divinely appointed conscience and choose to turn against godly life, that is, good life, They ask you to endorse immorality, subversion, illogicality, evil. To take the mark, symbolically speaking, on your forehead, your thought, and on your hand, your deeds. All by yourself. You have to do it. They can't make you do it. If, therefore, you are strong in your will and crystal clear in your inborn sense of good and bad, right and wrong, they can't really do much with you. They just move on to the next schmuck. And so they target people who are not strong in their will. That is their recruiting ground. People with a self-absorbed nature, people with a blaming instinct, people who drape themselves in victimhood, people who are always angry and complaining and miserable, but they don't ever bother to truly figure out the spiritual reasons behind their unrest. People who are quick to misidentify the real enemy. Watchers and their mannequins work very hard to establish pressurized conditions to induce a person into quietly but decisively forsaking truth. No truth, no God. No care, no God. No responsibility, no God. The hypnotic conditions to forsake truth may have a positive magnetic character, like the acquisition of power, money, houses, cars, boats, planes, legacy, status, achievement, whatever. Or distracting conditions, like games, sports, hobbies, leisure, holidays. Or negative, numbing conditions, like drugs, booze, pornography, fast food, binge-watching media or whatever. Or people who choose to live as psychopaths, sociopaths, or narcissists. Chosen behaviours, not illnesses. Volitional methods of dissociation. Means of abandonment. Whatever it takes to anaesthetise. Whatever circumstances are needed to get someone to decisively abscond from what is real. A major reason that living against God has become so popular is because it's marketed with the eye-catching benefit of irresponsible dissociation. Being able to live like you don't need to worry about anything anymore. Without God, nothing really matters. Nothing you do really matters. Nobody is really liable or answerable, as we've said 1,000 times on these recordings. There's no bigger reason to be alive than just to experience stuff. Your own pleasure and well-being. Nothing else. So you don't really need to bother about propriety or conscience, virtue, purpose, heavenly judgment, or big stuff like that. Just do whatever you like. For pleasure, for yourself, for a laugh. Without God, you are discharged of all responsibility. That's the sales pitch. It's not true, but that's the proposal. That's the spin. Imperial life is always irresponsible life. Sometimes furtive, and sometimes transparent. The acquiescent imperial citizen need do nothing more than tend to their own fantasies. Either off-the-peg fantasies for the unimaginative, or heavily personally customised ones for the more creative, dissociative artiste. You look around and wonder, is it possible that the everyday normie in modern society can still actually be good? What is goodness? I would say a good person is someone to whom truthfulness and moral conduct and spiritual integrity are instinctive, everyday, normative, automatic consecration of life, no compromise, natural. Goodness means glad and sacred responsibility, spirit-focused, not world-focused. This is not the goodness of empire, of course. Empire isn't in the least interested in this goodness. It smacks of godly things, for heaven's sake. Fallen watchers don't want you living like that. So they replace goodness with niceness, plastic mannequin smiles, congenial passive tolerance of evil, silent resignation. Let the flame go out. Just makes life easier. Externally, there are reenactments of fun, of love, of family, of community, of activities. Internally, there is shame, neglect, and disgrace. This is their niceness, spiritual euthanasia. Goodness is poison to those who have abandoned God. Remember that. Poison to the fallen watchers and their obsequious mannequins. The mannequin world leaders are explicitly commanded to slowly corrode their own lands, their own societies, by transforming them into imperial socialism. Empire is always socialist, like the fallen watchers who swore an oath to keep each other's evil. So they want you to join that. That's at the heart of their imperial socialism. It's socialism even when it looks fascist. Though socialism is not as popular as they'd like us to think it is, not as accepted, not as desired, so they have to fake it. They fake a consensus socialist majority via what? Guess what? Fake elections, fake statistics, fake humans, fake social media. And many people fall for it. Under peer pressure, they go along with it, because they don't like the danger of taking a stand against wrongness. The truth just isn't that important to them. And in this way, imperial culture guarantees uninterrupted misidentification of the enemy for all its citizens. No watchers, of course, no hybrids, are you crazy? No demons, I mean really, it's mythological savage talk, what are you talking about? No treacherous mannequins, no, it's just politics, that's all, comes and goes. Anything other than that, it's conspiracy, it's science fiction. We are the enemy. Within the naturalistic worldview, the callous weapon of identity politics, all the gay, gender, sexualization and race stuff, is explicitly designed to destroy our unity, to demoralize us, and to continually camouflage the identity of the real adversaries. Identity politics is so stupid, so wrong. All forms of it exist so the general unthinking population will misidentify the enemy. If we understood that reality, the enemy would be toast. They are doomed. I mean, they really are. I'm not just saying that. I'm not trying to be obliquely optimistic or something. The prophetic and eschatological picture presented in classical theology is quite clear that the bad guys are already predestined for the most severe punishment, followed by complete annihilation. But it sure would be nice to speed things up a bit. Fallen watchers, via their little theatre of empire, fill people's heads with all kinds of catchphrases like right-wing extremism, white supremacy, conspiracy theories, police reform, gun violence, climate change, carbon neutral, zero emissions, great resets, non-binary, gender fluid, transgender, minor attracted, critical race theory, white privilege, inclusion, diversity and all that. All fiction, decoys, untrue nonsense. The reason imperial citizens don't see this is because they don't want to. They don't want to see reality. But is it because they won't see, or is it because they can't see? And this point is sometimes explored theologically in the Arminian Calvinist debate. The Arminian view, named after Jacob Arminius, says they won't see. They choose not to exercise their free will ability to discern reality, to choose goodness and to come to God. The Calvinist view, on the other hand, named after John Calvin, says they can't see. They have no choice in their inability to discern reality, their incapacity for goodness, and they are destined to abandon God. I could do a 50-hour Romecast just talking about that can't, won't debate. And indeed, I do talk about this all the time in the course of my teaching work, week in, week out. But for now, for this recording, whether Imperial citizens won't care about reality, or can't care about reality, is uncertain. But what we can definitely say is that a great many people don't care about reality. They don't do good. They don't come to God. Even though it is the most beautiful, natural, empowering, healing, marvellous thing to do in the world. So we see ever more clearly that the living experience of a human life is intimately sculpted by the lens through which a person looks, their worldview. A supernaturalistic focused lens clarifies. A naturalistic unfocused lens obscures. Is the sharp focus of truth sometimes divisive, sometimes judgmental, sometimes offensive? Yes. Some people need shaking out of their paralyzing fiction. Some people who've had things upside down need to know that. Division is necessary so you can see the distinction between true and false, the clear line between the two. You want sound judgment upon you so you can recognize that you've made a mistake. So it's sometimes important to be offended so that you will feel your error, experience the dead weight of your own conceit. None of these things can hurt your soul, they only rattle the self. Big difference. Your personality, your pride, your emotional castle, your selfish dreams. Self. Self should be disturbed when it is dwelling in falsehood. Upset in order to bring about the possibility of change. Then there is a path to rejuvenation in humility and reverence. It is wrong to remain ignorant of the way things really are. It is wrong to disregard evil. It is irrational to not recognize right and wrong. It is sin to perpetuate a state of calculated unawareness, to just go along with things, to just live casually as a mannequin and go along with the mainstream narratives whilst you remain absorbed in self, to be unconcerned with what is true. Living like this is actively taking the mark and worshipping the beast system. 100%. For the last 2,000 years, due to the ascension of God in the person of Christ, corruption of the soul is something you can only do to yourself. A person must bring impiety upon themselves by their own hand. No excuses. Neither the fallen watchers, nor hybrids, nor demons, nor their vile little mannequin creatures can make you do anything inside your soul. Only you can do that. Do you place your living belief in God and his project to raise a family and transport it to a new world? Or do you reject that and instead pledge your fidelity, even indirectly by inaction, to the beast system of empire? Because those are your two choices. It's not a pretty end for the beast system, empire, those behind it and those who negligently go along with it in their selfish worship. Not a pretty end at all. The very precise apocalyptic language articulates a supreme devastation that awaits both watchers, demons, empire, false political and religious leaders, false prophets, and imperial citizens. An irrevocable and shattering termination. There is a word in German, Schlaflied, S-C-H-L-A-F-L-I-E-D, Schlaf, sleep, Lied, song, sleep song. If you type Schlaflied into a German to English translator, it's actually defined as lullaby, a song sung to babies to lull them to sleep. We have all, at one time or another, intoned sleep songs to quell the discontent of life, tapestries woven in the mind's eye to soothe and shield the heart, to cloak reality, enfolding it with fables. Sleep songs permit embellishments and disconnection. They are frequent concomitants of the naturalistic worldview. A sleep song gives a person unlimited license to contrive and simulate, to weave festive garlands around the crumbling brickwork of everyday misery. Sleep songs employ wish language when everyday language is too disheartening. It imagines, it play-acts, it amplifies or dampens as necessary. Sleep songs are for people who are not ready, not willing, and not able to face reality, to face the jolting good and evil of the world, to actually bear its load, to suffer it. And instead they withdraw into the poetic flight of the somnolent cradle song. They do not want testing or renewal. They want mental and emotional sleep. Not suffering. Sometimes they may appear to be people who are wholesome and pleasant. They know what to say and when to say it, and they go through the motions and all that. But if you look closely, they are shut down. Not letting light in, not letting light out. Intentionally smothering everything in the darkness of their secret fiction. The Schlaflied lies. It lies about our home and our work and our relationships. Our friends, our ambitions, our perceptions. Mostly exaggerating the goodness of it all. Telling you it's better than it is. And sometimes it can be the other way around. Sort of murmuring and bristling how things are worse than they actually are. It embroiders upward or downward, depending on the fears and desires of the individual, depending on their perceived need for survival of self. The sleep song is most apparent in the nonsense that it invents about relationships, imagining someone is other than they are, telling stories about how things are just great with someone when they are just not. And these lies are conveyed with such skill and tenacity that we actually start to believe them. We engineer reasons and excuses why they might be true. We sing the songs over and over until they feel real. Real enough to replace reality. We dream about how this person is so spiritual and deep. We dream about how a gravely dysfunctional family is really just fine. Lies, always lies. Tricks to avoid dealing with the necessary conflict. The reality of a person. The reality of a situation. The reality of a place, the reality of anything. What is real, however abysmal or blissful? You can see how external falsehoods in the world help to further garnish and bolster sleep songs. These fake movements we always talk about, all those false things are perfect, perfect lyrical fodder for sleep songs, greedily gobbled down by the unwise hallucinating addict. All this collateral fraudulence, just serving to further validate and fortify their own private sleep song. And it reinforces everyone else's too. So before long, everyone is merrily chanting fiction, lies to themselves and each other, and deep down they know it. Pleasurable, plausible, wounding lullabies. Spiritual life begins with the silencing of the sleep song. Let us not use our imagination to confound ourselves. Do not daydream your way to extinction. Face reality and know truth. Suffer the world. When the sleep songs stop, the silence clears the horizon. Clears the horizon for what is real. And the longer a song has been sung, the more acute the initial suffering. Very painful. But over time, it fades. This is what happens when someone begins to live without artifice, starting to live every day, facing the uncarved real world for the first time, to live without digressions, without poetic dreams, without sleep songs, to live simply as soul, to cover oneself in ashes, to go into the empty nocturnal desert and be nothing. To stare into unadorned reality. No songs, no mirages, just you. Stripped of all disguises. Humble, contrite, attendant. To breathe truth. To walk, to sit, to see, to listen, to feel. To create the conditions for spirit to indwell, the intelligent coalescent life force that emanates from God, through which one can know truth. A loving alliance between the created and the Creator. His Spirit flowing through all lands, all skies, all oceans, all souls, everything, all known. To share in this knowing. The graceful providence of divinity in all places at all times, flowing, infusing, bonding. This is why we are here. To dwell in this way. To live in reverence, in honour, in love. A life lived truthfully. You will grieve, yet you will be liberated. You will be lonely, yet you will find belonging. You will be emptied, yet you will be filled with light. The more silence, the more His Spirit indwells.
We hope you enjoyed listening to this Romecast. Neil Kramer loves you. You heard clips from the following. Dialogue from The Mandalorian. The song, Determination, by Bortex. Shared under a Creative Commons license. Dialogue from The Linden Tree, a play by J.B. Priestley. Dialogue from Danger Man. A clip from the song, Wandering Star, by Portishead. The song, Mystique, by Addie Goldstein. If you liked any of those clips, support the artists and go buy their stuff. That's all for now. See you again soon. Until then, we wish you a beautiful day.